Prohibition played a large role in building what I call the federal penal state.
Oh, America, repeal.
It was the era of the nation's first war on drugs. No simple repeal may get us out of this current crisis of mass incarceration. We need to rethink this penal and criminal approach toward drug addiction.
I say alcohol must go.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Booth, Reason TV, and today we're talking with historian Lisa McGurr. She's the author, most recently, of The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State. What are the biggest misconceptions about how prohibition affected American society?
The misconception is that it was a complete and total failure. Prohibition did fail. It was one of the greatest public policy failures in our history. It's the only constitutional amendment that was passed to be rescinded just less than 15 years later. But the reality is that that failure has led us to lose sight of the many long-term legacies that Prohibition left us with, and in particular, the role of Prohibition in terms of state building.
And define that when you say state building.
Well, Prohibition played a large role in building what I call the federal penal state. This was the moment where the federal government really beefed up its role in criminal justice, in crime control. It was the era of the nation's first war on drugs. Prior to Prohibition, the federal state was a bit player in crime control. And this is the time where the Prohibition experience and the war on crime that resulted because of the collateral violence of organized crime rings led to a new and permanent role for the federal government as a backstop to local and state law enforcement. It never lost it.
During Prohibition, I mean, part of the interesting thing about the books is you contrast parts of the country where Prohibition was really not enforced and it was widely flouted, and then in other places where it was never uniformly enforced, but it was enforced against particular types of people.
Right.
How is it that a place like New York, it wasn't as tightly enforced as, say, in parts of the South? Talk a little bit about why there were differences and how those played out.
It was a national law. In that way, the Volstead Act was a uniform national law, but every state had its own enforcement code. And those codes were different. So some states were more restrictive than others. And where there was a lot of dry sentiment, enforcement was taken very seriously, leading to rising rates of incarceration, overcrowded prisons. In places like New York, there was an enormous amount of wet sentiment. This was an immigrant, industrial, large city, cosmopolitan place. And so already in 1923, New York rescinded its state enforcement law.
Right. They basically said, we're not in the business
of enforcing this.
Right.
If you want to enforce, it's up to the federal government.
Right.
We're not going to become involved in enforcing this.
But then talk about in North Carolina and Virginia, who were the people when Prohibition was being enforced? Who were the people who were feeling the pain?
The people who were feeling the pain were largely poor, marginal violators, working class men and women, whether it be African in Virginia, it's African Americans in places like Richmond and city centers, poor whites in rural areas, but overwhelmingly, whether you're looking at Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, or Los Angeles, it's where it was Mexican Americans, it's largely groups that had already been identified in public discourse as kind of breeders of criminality. So marginal groups that were already discriminated against received the bulk of
enforcement. So, it really is like not a dry run, I guess a wet run for the war on drugs.
One can think about, there are so many parallels between the war on what I call the war on alcohol and the later war on drugs. One could argue that in some ways it served as a dress rehearsal for the later war on drugs, in the sense that it was shorter lived, it was more controversial, and so federal officials learned from that experience. And at the end of Prohibition, did not remove themselves from regulating other narcotic substances, but moved forward in new campaigns and new directions. And it's, of course, The war on alcohol and the war on drugs were symbiotic campaigns. It's something which is a story not widely known, but those two campaigns emerged together. They had the same shared set of logics. Many of the same individuals were involved in both campaigns. So, for example, the father of alcohol prohibition, Richmond Hobson, who was the highest paid lecturer for the Anti-Saloon League. In the 1920s, however, he moved increasingly to turn his energies toward prohibiting what he considered a new menace, other narcotic drugs. So in 1923, he established the International Narcotics Education Association. In 1927, he established the International Narcotics Defense League. And he worked as this kind of moral entrepreneur with State Department officials, with folks within the Narcotics Bureau, to build an international drug control regime. That, of course, far outlasted the war on alcohol and went forward in new directions. Another figure, of course, was Harry Anslinger, who came directly out of the Prohibition Bureau and was appointed by Herbert Hoover in the spanking new, newly born Federal Bureau of Narcotics.
To Harry Jacob Anslinger, distinguished citizen, in your dedicated efforts to combat the illegal traffic in narcotic drugs, you have fashioned an effective organization to pursue this objective. Your noteworthy achievements in this field have earned for you the respect of the world community. Signed, John F. Kennedy.
The campaign shared logic, they shared a set of officials, they shared institutional spaces, so the Narcotics Bureau came directly out of the Prohibition Bureau. So in some ways you could argue that that war never ended after the war on alcohol, namely the war on narcotic drugs.
What kind of politician was Al Smith, and how did he kind of reconfigure national politics?
I think he's such a fascinating personality. Smith was a three-time governor of New York. He himself came out of, was an Irish immigrant. He was Catholic. He started out in the early 20s, coming out of World War I, as a relatively on the progressive end of the political spectrum, but his reputation, his national reputation, largely was built around the issue of prohibition opposition.
My privilege to deliver to you the first case of Budweiser beer to be delivered in the state of New York. Happy days are here again.
But for the first time since the Empire State was built, I got a real thrill when I saw the six big horses coming along with the wagon load of beer. The only regret I have is that it isn't all for me.
He linked that opposition very much to a wider ethos of tolerance, social tolerance. He identified the war on alcohol as an attack on immigrant culture, immigrant and Catholics as well. And he built a really sort of role within the Democratic Party as the leader of the standard bearer for prohibition opposition. And in so doing, he drew an enormous amount of support among rank and file ethnic immigrants, many of whom had never voted before, who had not really been involved in national politics, and who, as a result, by 1928, despite the fact that he lost nationally, nonetheless really helped to realign party politics by bringing in this entire new constituency into the Democratic Party.
What happened to the Republican Party? Because it seemed like, I mean, as the country was industrializing and urbanizing, Al Smith, through prohibition opposition, brings immigrants in.
That's right.
But then the Republican Party, which had owned a lot of cities or run a lot of cities, they started moving to the kind of the small towns.
They did, because a lot of those who had been at the base of the voting base of the Republican Party in cities, places like Pittsburgh, places like Philadelphia, even in Boston, where you had the Italian immigrants, many of whom were voting Republican, same in New York, by 1928, they are increasingly moving out of the Republican Party into the Democratic Party because of the issue of prohibition opposition and because of Al Smith's leadership. So that the Republican Party is breaking apart, losing those set of supporters who are increasingly moving into the Democratic Party by 32.
And this is partly, obviously there's economic upheaval, but also Al Smith represented them in a way. The Republican Party was moving more towards a nativism during the 20s?
Well, what there is not yet economic upheaval, right? It's not,
right.
Which is interesting, right? So the realignment that happens in 28 happens before the Great Depression crisis and before the New Deal. And it's around an issue that the, right, prohibition is identified as an attack on immigrant ethnic culture. So you could say it's a kind of ethnically linked issue, concern over nativism, concern over intolerance that is bringing these folks into the Democratic Party, but it's also a class-tinged issue because it is precisely poor men and women who are those who are sort of the subset of groups that are around which prohibition is being heavily enforced.
What is the lesson from the end of prohibition that we might think about in an era of criminal justice reform?
Mm-hmm. These large-scale campaigns, which many sort of progressive and sort of well-intentioned men and women signed on to because they saw the problem of alcohol particularly for poor men and women. They saw the ravages of addiction on these groups. They wanted to protect groups from those ravages and outlaw an industry, you know, in order to do so. What it teaches us is that those campaigns are going to be unsuccessful, and that the approach, a penal and criminal approach toward recreational narcotic substances, is something which is not going to succeed. And I think that's a lesson which we learned about alcohol, but we did not learn relative to other drugs. In fact, that, as I mentioned, that campaign continued and increasingly focused on other drugs. In 1937, we get the Federal Marijuana Tax Act, and the sort of effort to prohibit other forms of narcotic substances. So we have yet to learn that wider lesson. And I think what we should take away from this looking back on the war on alcohol is that it hopefully can teach us something about our current crisis, which is that while no simple repeal may get us out of this current crisis of mass incarceration, we need to rethink this penal and criminal approach toward drug addiction. It is simply doesn't work. We need to find other approaches that focus on harm reduction and not work on these, you know, stop pursuing this kind of war against drugs, which has really failed.
Hopefully we're at the beginning stages of that. We will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Lisa McGurr, who's the author most recently of The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.